Remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thanks, Kelly. This is Mikey. Welcome to the vertical integration call for this week. We have a lot of folks online and a pretty simple agenda. Mostly we're going to focus on the matrix that we've all been working on, but special thanks to Kathy Kleeman for being scribe on that. We have one new proposal, the IPC proposal, and so we'll kick off with that. Oh, Eric, could you mute your line, please? Thanks. We'll have a short update on sort of the way things are shaping up in Brussels for the face-to-face meeting slot. Thanks to all who filled out the doodle, and we'll give you an update on that. Is there anything else that is really on people's mind that they want to insert into the agenda at this point? I think the main focus really needs to be on the matrix and beginning the conversation of the next few weeks where we try to find where, if any, we've got areas of consensus. So, sorry, Eric. I didn't mean to falsely accuse you on that. Anyway, I'm not hearing a great deal of conversation about the agenda, so I'm going to take that as a sign that we should proceed. Gisela, could you go ahead and call the roll?
Absolutely. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone on today's Vertical Integration, Monday the 17th of May. We have Mike O'Connor, Jotun Frakes, Siva Mutasami, Faisal Shah, Jeffrey Eckhouse, Barry Cobb, Keith Razek, Michael Palage, Jeff Newman, Boudouin Chombe, Catherine Ulmer, Jarko Ruska, Alan Greenberg, Steve Pinkos, Eric Brunner-Williams, Avery Doria, Sébastien Bachelet, Volker Greimann, Christina Rosette, Phil Buckingham, Tara Mustala, Ron Andruff, Roberto Gaetano, Staten Hammock, Richard Tindall, Scott Austin, Thomas Barrett, Tim Ruiz, John Nevitt, Graham Chenoweth, Jean-Christophe Vigne, and Brian Cute. From staff, we have Glenda Saint-Géry, Mike Zupke, Margie Milam, Dan Holleran, Amy Status, myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Michele Nalon, Cheryl Langdon-Orr, Banda Scartasini. If I can please remind everyone to state their names before speaking for transcript purposes, please use star 6 to mute and star 6 again to unmute. Thank you. Over to you, Mikey.
Thanks, Gisela, and thanks to all of you. Moving right along, Christina's up first to give us sort of an introduction to the IPC proposal. Christina, I didn't know if you had anything specific to put up on the screen, so we're just carrying the matrix with the IPC row in it. But if you have something else that you'd like to have on the screen instead, just email it to me, and I'll quickly put it up for you. Over to you.
I don't, Mikey. And I guess what I'd like to do, simply because I think, you know, one of the benefits of the matrix is also one of its disadvantages, namely that you have to really condense everything. So what I'd like to do is just go through the proposal more broadly and tracing back to the IPC constituency statement and then circling back to the matrix itself. I should say at the outset that the IPC generally supports the strict separation approach approved by the board thus far. But we do believe that there are circumstances under which exceptions should be recognized. And what we've proposed here are three variations of a dot brand registry model that we believe, if they meet the relevant criteria that we've set out, should be treated as an exception from the strict separation requirement. I should also note that there was a fair amount of discussion within the IPC about, you know, do we believe that we should be proposing a more broad single registrant exception and various iterations of that. And the decision ultimately that we reached as a constituency was that because we are the intellectual property constituency, that we would focus within our remit. And the fact that we're not proposing anything more broad or more general doesn't necessarily mean that we wouldn't support it. It's just, again, to recognize the scope that our remit is considered to be quite narrow. So in any event, registry meets one of the following, it falls within the relevant models and meets the seven additional criteria, we think that it should be allowed to control an ICANN-accredited registrar solely for the purpose of sponsoring registrations in that particular .brand TLD, should not be required to use an ICANN-accredited registrar for registration of second-level names within that gTLD, or be permitted to enter into exclusive arrangements with one or a limited number of ICANN-accredited registrars for the purpose of sponsoring registrations in that TLD. The first model that we've set forth is what we've referred to as branded single registrant, single user, where that brand, where the brand holder is the registered name holder and all and the user of all the second-level domains in the TLD. This would be where the owner slash holder operates the registry directly or indirectly. It's the registered name holder for all of the second-level names and is the user of all second-level names, that no second-level names are registered or delegated to third parties with the exception of wholly owned subsidiaries or what would be considered otherwise affiliated companies. We gave an example in our model, and we tried to stay away from using specific brands. But what we were thinking about was, for example, in a model of a retailer, which we identified as its brand would be Buy Stuff. It would be the registry, the sole registered name holder. And, for example, locations.buystuff, housewares.buystuff, all of those second-level names would be registered in its name and used by it directly. The second model that we proposed was a branded single registrant multiple related user. And the difference there is that the trademark owner is still the registry. They're still the registered name holder of all the second-level domains, but they license those second-level names to third parties that have a pre-existing delineated relationship with the brand owner where the domain where the registration agreement that would control that license is essentially part of an ancillary to a primary agreement for goods or services between the trademark owner and the licensee. And when I say primary agreement for goods or services, I mean goods or services other than domain name registration-related goods or services. The third was, and I should note that when we get to this third one, that in its initial iteration, there were two additional models that after circulation of the proposal, the IPC decided that it would be more appropriate to narrow what we were proposing, and so we've dropped those additional two. But the third and final one is where you would have a branded trademark license, multiple registrant, multiple user. And again, this would be where the adopt brand, where the trademark owner and its licensees, trademark licensees, are the registered name holders and users of all the second-level names. And this would be kind of lend itself to franchises, you know, dot Fassburger, and you could have a particular franchisee in a particular location have a second-level name that corresponded to his or her name or to the location, again, kind of setting aside for now some of the geographic issues that that are going to come into play in new gTLDs. And so the idea with this model was that it would be important for trademark owners that wanted to maintain strict control over registration of second-level names, but that wanted to have some flexibility as to how who was identified as the second-level registrant. Turning now to the specific conditions that would apply to all of these models, the first would be that. And implicit in among all of this is that the dot brand has to be an identical match to a trademark owned by the trademark owner. And more specifically, the trademark to which the dot brand is an identical match has to be the subject of trademark registrations of national effect in at least three countries in each of at least three of the five ICANN regions. This was felt to be an important criteria to try and minimize and eliminate gaming and abuse of the exception. And, in fact, that was what motivated many of these additional criteria to make sure that they really only applied to the types of models and the types of entities that we envisioned that this exception would apply to. There was not unanimity within the IPC on this particular requirement. There were some that felt that it was too stringent, but the overall consensus was that that this is where it should be. For first-round applicants, those trademark registrations of national effect that I've just talked to had to have issued on or before June 27, 2008, which is the date of the board resolution in Paris relating to new GTLDs. Third, the dot brand exemption is inapplicable to trademark owners whose principal business is the operation of a domain name registry, registrar, or reseller. And again, this is one that was felt to be most relevant for purposes of avoiding gaming. The relationship between the dot brand TLD and its customer slash registered name holder, to the extent that that is a third party, is defined by terms of an agreement that is kind of incorporates the terms of a registration agreement, but is really broader and more directed at a kind of traditional trademark license agreement or franchise distribution agreement. The additional criteria really relate to who the second level registrations are used by, and in the second and third models, though, held in trust by the TLD operator and not delegated to a third-party user. And I think that's a typo, and that should be in models 1 and 2. Actually, in model 1, there is no third-party user. And then in the model 3, although the second level dot brand registrations are delegated to the user, they're under quality control provisions of a traditional trademark license agreement that would allow the registry to terminate the registration at will if the second-level registration was used in a way that went beyond the scope of that agreement. And we've listed some very kind of general objectives for why we suggested this, really to kind of guard consumers from potential harm, to encourage innovation within the new GTLD space, to allow rights holders to provide maximum value and choice. And in fact, I should just note that, you know, a number of board members have made over the past several years suggestions to the trademark community that a dot brand TLD would, in fact, be the answer to all of their cyber squatting woes. So this is kind of our response, is to say, great, let's go for it. Turning to the matrix, it was, again, it was, yeah?
Just a comment from the chat that you're covering a lot of ground awfully fast, and some of the non-English speakers are having a tough time keeping up. So
you can slow down,
and if you run out of time, I'll give you more.
I apologize. No, and I apologize. I'm under a time constraint. I can't be on for much of the call, so I wanted to try and get through this as quickly as I could. Generally speaking, what I've indicated in the matrix here is that for cross-ownership, you know, it's essentially 0% subject to these exceptions that we put forward. If the registrar agrees not to distribute the registry's TLD, is more cross-ownership allowed? And the answer to that is no, kind of given the context of these exceptions. Use of ICANN-accredited registrars would not be required for TLD registries that met the various, not only the model, but the additional criteria. And similarly, that a qualified dot brand registry should be allowed to enter into exclusive arrangements with one or more ICANN-accredited registrars so that it could have the opportunity to select among registries. And non-discrimination, again, kind of no for the qualified dot brand exceptions, but yes for all others. It got kind of complicated and fairly tricky to answer the community GTLD exception, the orphan GTLD exception, because there's a recognition within the IPC that you know, there are definitely dot brands that could meet the requirements for a community TLD. And similarly, to the extent that a brand TLD has some fairly significant requirements, like posting of a bond, to ensure that unqualified third parties don't get second-level registrations or the like, that there is a possibility that some of these brand TLDs may essentially be considered orphan TLDs. So even though I put no in the matrix, it's really kind of with the understanding that some of the dot brands could, in fact, be communities, community GTLDs or orphan GTLDs. Under the qualified.brand models, again, meeting the additional criteria, could potentially distribute names directly. I put not applicable for a number of the other columns simply because under the kind of under the exception, it was hard to kind of say yes or no. I should note that our model and proposal didn't speak specifically to the reseller on the RSP, and I'm seeking clarification for from the IPC as to whether we're going to say not applicable or whether we're going to amend, with the understanding that if we're going to amend, that we need to do that very quickly. And I think that's it.
Thanks, Christina. I'll give you a minute to catch your breath. And there are several questions that came from the queue. Eric is first. And he's got two questions. The first question is, I'll read it off the chat. Where in the DAG is the SR type? I think this is probably actually a broader discussion for the whole group, but, Eric has raised this point several times on the list, which is that the status of this single registrant idea is sort of in flux. Do you want to take a swing at that before I throw that out to the whole group for a little bit of a conversation?
Other than to say that I agree, but there's really nothing in the DAG that I'm aware of that would specifically prohibit it. And again, I think that there, depending upon how you wanted to interpret, for example, some of the community requirements, I think it's there. And if it's not there, a number of the board members seem to think it's there because the trademark owners are hearing a lot about it from them.
Okay. Let me just do Eric's second question, and then we'll get to Tim, and then I've got a question from Jonathan. But then Eric followed up, kind of lost in chat here. The second question of he was asking how many dot brands does the IPC advocate if dot brand is a cure for cyber squatting?
Well, at the outset, just so that we're clear, I don't believe the IPC is taking the position that dot brands are a cure for cyber squatting. This is how ICANN staff and board members have been advocating the idea of new GTLDs to the trademark community. So to the extent that there is such a position, I think that question is better directed at those staff members and board members who are, in fact, taking it. Having said that, as long as a GTLD applicant can meet the criteria that we've set out, we don't see a need for a numerical limit. I mean, theoretically, if you can meet all the criteria, it could be, 50, it could be 200, it could be 300. I don't think that there's necessarily any determination on a numerical limit that would apply.
Okay. Tim, you're next.
Thanks, Mike. Actually, some observations, and Christina might want to respond to them, so that's not necessarily questions, but just that, I know the board, maybe others have talked a lot about, dot brand TLDs, whatever you want to call them. I don't think they were necessarily implying that there was some special case associated with that. There's certainly nothing in any version of the draft applicant guidebook that would prevent a brand owner or a trademark owner for applying for their brand or their trademark as a TLD. So I think that option has always been there. There's no restrictions on the string. So what we're talking about here, though, is making it a special case by providing exceptions that I don't recall the board or anyone else having promoted or suggested, at least that I'm aware of. And if so, even then, they certainly haven't been provided for in the DAG up till now. And so just in regards to the exceptions themselves, I mean, in the first case that Christine was talking about with the single registrant, single user, in all reality, I mean, with very little change, it's pretty much possible today. I mean, there isn't anything that I see in the guidebook that would necessarily prevent that. There might be some minor tweak in the registry agreement to provide for it, but certainly even the existing registries like Info and Biz and others, we're allowed to reserve certain second-level names up front, and in many cases several hundred, if not, I think in some cases even thousands perhaps. And those names, are for registry use. They're registered to the registry. They're not registered through an accredited registrar, but those are all provided for up front and can be used. So like affilius.info, I believe if you look that up, there's no registrar associated with that registration, yet that domain's in use because it belongs to the registry, it's for registry use, et cetera. So in a lot of ways, if you look at it that way, the first case is already possible. What concerns me about the other cases is two main issues. One is the competition issue, because it seems to me it presents or could create an unfair competition advantage by allowing exceptions. Because when you think about the number of brands or the number of trademarks that actually exist in the world that might qualify for this, you're basically taking tens of thousands easily, if not millions, of potential customers out of the market and giving them straight to trademark and brand owners who have various exceptions on uses of registrar and being able to sell direct and things like that generic TLDs typically don't have or typically won't have in the program. Because when you look at the broadest sense, broadest application of these exceptions, it's going to cover, just about every business or possibly every business or company on the planet, except for perhaps some nonprofits, I think, as Aubrey was noting on the list. So that concerns me. And then just the enforcement aspect of it, I think, and I'm not trying to imply I can't enforce this contracts or whatever, but, we have to be realistic that the more complicated that these exceptions become and the more in-depth that I can have to look at third-party agreements and, all kinds of arrangements, business structures and all these kinds of things, it just makes it more and more difficult, more and more expensive for ICANN to be able to adequately enforce those things. So I think that alone should make a step back and take a look at this. So I'm not saying, these things wouldn't have some value and that maybe they shouldn't be discussed further. My biggest concern is that with the time we have, can these kinds of exceptions be made? Can we adequately really study and research this so that we make the right decisions before this first round goes out? And I think given that, the first case can already be done, that we're best off, leaving these more intricate exceptions for further discussion in a later round. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Do you want to comment on that, Christina?
Just very briefly, as to your first point, I absolutely agree that having a dot brand TLD is different from having a dot brand TLD that qualifies for exceptions to cross-ownership and vertical integration. And that was not at all where I was not at all intending to suggest that the latter already existed or that board members and staff have been advocating that. So to the extent that was what you understood me to say, that wasn't what I intended to say. With regard to the single registrant, single user situation, this would be, maybe that is the answer. Maybe this is what we limited to. But again, these are the three models that the IPC has heard the most requests for from its members. And as to the competition issues, in terms of taking TLD customers out of the market because they're not going to be registering names, I think in many cases that's not really true. You're going to be taking the same TLD customer, particularly where it's a single user, and really just minimizing the number of registrations that entity gets through third parties. And frankly, I think you're going to see that anyway with new TLDs. As to the enforcement issues, I think, if you have more variations, if you have more enforcement issues, I think that's true. I don't think that there's any necessarily disagreement there. But I also think that because of the monetary value that a dot, that a brand has to its owner, that there are much greater considerations at play here in terms of maintaining and protecting the goodwill associated with the mark. The last thing any smart trademark owner is going to do is take any action that's going to reflect badly on its brand. So I think, you know, as a practical matter, are you likely to have enforcement issues? You know, I don't really know. And as just, if I could just respond kind of preemptively to a question on the chat about, you know, what do you do about Apple not being able to get .iPad? That was one of the issues that the IPC went, you know, there was a fair amount of discussion about that, is, you know, how do you deal with the time cutoff? And that's why for the first round, we figured that this would be a cutoff that could be used. And as to how do you redelegate them, you have that issue anyway, regardless of whether they get a vertical integration or cross-ownership exception. And, in fact, that's an issue of significant concern to trademark owners and potentially significant liability exposure to ICANN if they reallocate a .brand TLD to an entity that has no association with that brand. But, you know, that's a conversation for another time.
Thanks, Christina. Jonathan had a question on the list, and then we'll go back to the queue. Jonathan's question was, is the IPC only suggesting that brands, that, is the IPC suggesting that brands only receive the exception, or is this identification that brands might be an example of where it is likely an exception to be merited? Jonathan, if you can jump off mute. I can't make sense out of that now that I read it.
No, I understand what he's asking.
Okay.
And I think the answer isn't definitely the former, definitely the latter. I think it's closer to the latter in the sense that there was definitely consideration about the possibility that there could be other exceptions. But again, because we are the IP constituency, that we thought it was more appropriate to focus on, you know, one particular exception to that that fell within our, you know, the, our remit under both the constituency bylaws and the ICANN bylaws.
Thank you, Christina.
Way to go. Richard, by the way, we're running a little over time. I'm going to give it another 4 minutes till 35 after the hour, and then I think we're going to have to draw a line under this one. So if folks could sort of offer short questions and Christina short replies, that would be helpful.
Sure.
Richard?
Yeah, a question for Christina. And I think the answer is yes, Christina, but perhaps rather than just yes, you might want to elaborate a little bit, unless the answer is no, which you can tell me that as well. But if I had a trademark for, say, the word music that met the criteria that you outlined as being required, you know, so many national registrations, et cetera, I take it then that I would be able to operate music under the same sort of single registrar scenario that you described. Is that correct? And if so, could you elaborate on implications of that?
Yes, as long as you're meeting all the criteria and you fall within the model strictly, sure. But I think the implications are perhaps not as broad as you're kind of implying as they may be, because as a practical matter, you will have to, some of those conditions and some of the restrictions on the model are going to not necessarily, in fact, won't lend themselves to generic use of a word that also functions as a trademark, because in that case you're not going to have a trademark license in operation because you can't license a generic word. So if you're talking about .music for .music, not really that concerned about it. If you're talking about .music for perfume, then I think, you know, then you're going to be able to meet the qualifications.
Thanks, Christina. Aubrey.
Yeah, I have two questions, one of which, they should both be quick, and one of which is for Christina and one of which is for the chairs and the group in general. The first one, Christina, if I understood your last correct comment or one before, basically, if a set of conditions as stringent as your trademark one could be established for non-commercial international organizations or such as that, then that's not something that, that your proposal has an immediate problem with. But it would have to be something that would have a similar level of, you know, have been around for 50 years, have be well known by that name in many, et cetera. Is that a correct understanding?
The answer is I don't know, because it's not a hypothetical that was put forward to the IPC, and that's what this is a constituency statement. I think, speaking personally, I think if you can make the same rationale for exclusion and control and restricting the gaming, I would think that there's definitely something to be considered. But again, I think in these exceptions, it really comes down to the specifics.
Okay, thank you. The wider question I had is, we hear the statement very often, where in Index B3 is such and such permitted? And I'd just like to offer that that's really not a relevant question when basically we've been asked to contribute to future DAGs what should be discussed in terms of vertical integration. There's all kinds of things we can come up with that may or may not have been thought about in earlier versions of the DAG. So I'd just like to point out and perhaps ask others if they think that that is a relevant question. Thank you.
Thanks, Avery, and thanks, Christina. I'm going to draw a line under this chunk of the agenda. I appreciate the speed with which you covered a lot of territory, and we'll move on to the next part. To respond to Avery's second question, at least it's my impression as a co-chair, that we have fairly substantial latitude in terms of what kinds of things we can describe and propose, both in the near term and in the longer term. I do want to reemphasize that we really have two, for the price of one, missions. We have the short-term mission, which is very short, which is to come up with a description of consensus that can be inserted into the essentially this round's applicant guidebook. And then we have a much longer term mission, which is a vastly wider and deeper discussion of vertical integration that presumably will go into the next round. And I think that we have a fair amount of latitude in both. So I would tend to agree that if we could come to consensus around single registrant type language, that that's within our remit, both short and long term. I don't know, Roberto, do you want to comment on that, or shall we push along to the matrix?
No, I don't have any specific comment. I think we can go ahead.
Okay. Margie, I'm assuming that your screen is the one that's showing the matrix, and as we get started, I was going to ask you if you could see if you could rejigger it so that the whole matrix shows up. I think it's cutting off.
Yeah, actually, it's set so each of you can do it yourself.
Yeah, it's cutting off to the...
Yeah, I had a hard time converting it to
okay. To those of you on the call who have ready access to the list, I posted, and I apologize for posting two back-to-back, but I did post the same file to the list just before the call, and it's probably going to be easier for folks to follow along actually using the Excel spreadsheet rather than the stuff on Adobe. Oh, Kim, I didn't see your hand was up. Do you have a comment before we go on? Or is that left over from before?
I'm sorry, that was left over. I'll put it down.
No worries. I think that I would like to essentially spend about 15 minutes just allowing us to talk to each other about what we see in the matrix so far, areas where we seem to be converging, areas where we are diverging, but I think that there's a fair amount to digest in this matrix, and before we get terribly specific on approach, I'd like to have just sort of a general conversation along the lines of clarifying entries, finding similarities, finding areas of convergence. And then from there, I'd like to spend some time sort of talking about your preference as a group as to how to move the ball forward mechanically. I have some ideas, but I don't want to put those in the way of a broader, more general discussion about what we know so far. So, Kathy, do you want to chime in with any observations? You were the scribe, and often scribes see stuff as they're scribing. By the way, I'm going to ask Kathy, maybe after the call, whether she'd like to give up the pen, partly because it sounds like she's really busy, and if she would like to do that, I will. I'm retired, so I'm not nearly as busy, and I could cheerfully take up the pen on that, but we'll talk about some of the mechanics later. Kathy, any thoughts before we throw it open to the broader group?
Well, first, thanks, Mikey, for picking up the pen this morning when I was in meeting, so thank you so much for getting out the most recent versions of the table. An observation that the MMA proposal should probably move from line 8 up to line 3 so that we put all the cross-ownerships that started 0% together. Thanks to John Nevitt for helping create some of the granularity in the equal access concepts. It turns out when I talk to people about, and I just wanted to share this with the group, when I talked about, for example, how registries, say in the exceptions, whether it's the single registrant exception or the community exception or the orphan exception, when I talked about how the registry would distribute domain names under the threshold, under whatever threshold you accept, 30,000, 50,000. Everyone had a very different idea. Some thought that the registry would distribute directly. Some thought that they would distribute through registrars under equal access or of their choice. Some thought that they could 100% co-own a registrar. So breaking this out so that there's nothing implicit, that it's all explicit, so we can talk about it, I think was really helpful. And yes, I see a lot of convergence. I see a lot of ground for bringing things together. But I haven't analyzed it as fully as I need to do. But I did want to know the time frame, Mikey, and I'm sorry about that, but let me come back to that. How much time do we have to pull this together so that it makes a difference either in the current guidebook or what's going forward? Because a lot of things are closing this week, so I was wondering about how all the schedules pull together.
This is Mikey. Let me just expound on that for a minute. Essentially, what I've proposed is a slightly different than the normal model, in which what we will be doing is essentially taking a snapshot of where we are every week, and this matrix is the first iteration of that. And we will continue to take snapshots as long as it takes up till Brussels. In Brussels, we are not on deck to present a report. We are on deck to present a status update. And the situation with the applicant guidebook is a little bit complicated because the deadline for input to the guidebook is passed. That was the deadline that went by on May 15th. In talking to Kurt about this, the thought is that we still have a window open to respond to the board's invitation to develop an alternative proposal and have it considered by the board and perhaps adopted and inserted into the guidebook during the cycle of approval that effectively lasts until October, but in reality, we have a couple of pretty firm chunks of time that we need to spend. We need to go out for another round of public comment and constituency statements. And so, effectively, if we're going to come to a consensus about anything and have it make it into the guidebook, if I were being entirely cynical, I would say we have until May 31st, which is the deadline for materials going into Brussels, and I would put a lot of pressure on the group. In reality, I think we have a little bit more flexibility, but I think we do have to arrive at consensus before Brussels, because after Brussels, we then need to immediately jump into the process of public comment and refinement on whatever we come up with in order to make the window of getting into the applicant guidebook in a reasonable way. So that's kind of a long-winded way of saying to arrive at consensus, I think effectively we have 3 or 4 weeks, and whatever we come up with in that time is what we'll be able to bring forward in Brussels, and everything else will have to defer to the longer, broader version of our mission.
Thank you.
Anything else, Kathy, before I move on to the queue?
Just a call for everyone to look with me to see where they see the convergences and who they can reach out to help create them. Hopefully the table provides a guide for us as a group and a guide for us as individuals or organizations. Thank you.
Thanks again, Kathy. Jeff, Eckhouse, go ahead.
Thanks. I just wanted to actually I got confused for a sec, but I think Kathy cleared it up that this table, I just want to be careful that this table, matrix, whatever we want to call it, is being used just as, let's call it an internal tool for this group to see where there's consensus, where there's differences, and to help people reach out to each other, that we're not packaging this and distributing it to either the board or outside people. I thought I heard somebody say that, and then I just wanted to clarify that and make sure. And then Kathy reiterated at the end that it would be used for people to reach out, but that this won't be packaged up and sent out to anyone as saying, hey, this is where the current – I wouldn't want outside people to say this is the current status of where the group is. I just want to clarify that point.
Thanks, Jeff. And there's a little bit of a nuanced answer there. I mean, this is a public email list, and – so,
it was
people
I can
know
that.
Yeah.
Oh, I
can indeed see
that. Yes, and anybody can open up and take a look and see where it is, but there is a difference between that and us sending it out saying here is the work of the
right.
Of this working group and this is where we currently stand versus, it's a push versus pull sort of presentation. I guess that's my point there.
Yep. Well, and actually, you're getting to something I was going to talk about in a minute, but I'm going to jump on the opportunity to talk about it now, and that is that, as others have raised on the calls in earlier calls, what we really need to do now is get to a single draft of that describes whatever it is that we're proposing. And the mechanics of getting to that draft are something that I want to discuss later and hoping for some ideas on. But it's that single draft that we'll take snapshots of and push forward week by week. Right now that draft is very short because it hasn't been started yet. But hopefully over the next few weeks, a draft will start to emerge that represents where we stand on this, and that's what's going to get brought forward. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess my comments were on the same issue that, I didn't update this or participate in this exercise with this grid with the idea that this was going to become somehow a consensus gauging document. In fact, I was trying to make that point before in the last call, that this shouldn't be viewed as that, but perhaps as a tool perhaps to help us move in that direction. So that's my understanding of this document, and if anyone listening to these calls or looking at this document who's not participating actively is thinking somehow this is a reflection of consensus, that's way off base. I mean, at the beginning of this call, I think we heard something like 40 people on this call, and this document reflects, the writing / views of less than half of that. I don't know if some of these documents our consensus views, the IPC appears that it may be. I don't think that's necessarily true in regards to the others, certainly not from the registrar's perspective, because I think there's at least half a dozen registrars or more involved in at least three of these proposals that don't agree with each other. So clearly, this is not a consensus document. I want to make sure that we don't ever give that impression, and that any work we do towards consensus, this is only a tool for that, and anything we're going to provide with the board or staff before the next draft applicant guidebook has yet to be created. At least that's the way I view things.
I think that's completely in line with where I'm at too, Tim. That, you know, we need now to start focusing on getting to a draft. One of the interesting questions is how are we going to do that? I would call on all of you to think about that for the next few minutes before we get to that part of the conversation, because I think there are probably ways to get that done better than others, and I think we need to talk a little bit about how we're going to approach that. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, can we have some clarity on how we're using consensus? Sometimes when you're saying we reach consensus, it sounds like you're saying we reach unanimous consensus, that is, everyone agrees.
No,
talking about general consensus, which means most people, however we count.
I forget that this is not an exclusively GNSO group, so I need to back up. The GNSO has got terms that we use for the degree of consensus. There's unanimous consensus, and then I'm going to falter over the terms, but there are several layers of less consensus and then a layer that says no, that there isn't consensus there. I'm using it in that context rather than in the pure unanimous.
I guess the question I'm asking is, of the 11 proposals, if 9 or 10 of them agree that 14.36% separation is the exact right number, is that consensus?
I think that
that's a hypothetical answer. Question.
I think you get the consultant's answer, which is it depends.
Okay,
but it does not mean unanimous consensus. At the same time, the goal is as close to that as possible, paying special attention to minority points of view, because that's what consensus decision making is very interested in, is the views of the non-majority participants. And so we'll have to just wait and see on that. But it does not mean 100% unanimous agreement.
Thank you.
Tim, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment about that, about the consensus part of it. I think it's important we think very carefully about it, because what we present, we don't know what will happen with it after we do that. It isn't like we can count on the board taking what we give them or staff and putting it into practice verbatim. So we might be a little bit surprised at how what we provide gets used or actually implemented. So not only do we need to be clear, but we need to be very thoughtful about what we decide to put the moniker of consensus behind. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Any other comments in general about the table, areas of convergence, issues, concerns? The next step, it seems to me, I'm drawing on my recent experience in a completely different policymaking arena, in that I'm also a broadband policy guy. And when we developed the broadband policy for the state of Minnesota last year, one of the things that we did was essentially the exercise that we are completing, I don't think we've completed, but completing now, where we essentially staked out the range of positions. But then we began driving ourselves towards a single draft in an effort to give people the chance to negotiate, basically. I mean, essentially what this is at this stage of the game is a negotiation. And if we are successful in negotiating a single draft, that's fantastic. And if we're not, that just means that Roberto and I have less presenting to do in Brussels, and we'll move on to the next phase of the work. Where I'm a little bit uncomfortable is that I have not participated in an ICANN negotiation with this many parties before. And I'm now sort of talking in professional negotiation speak. I'm not a professional negotiator, but when Jeff Eckhouse mentioned BATNA, I sort of woke up and went, ah, yes, I remember that term. Because although I wasn't a professional negotiator for the union negotiations at the University of Minnesota, I was the representative of one of the parties. I was the controller and associate VP for finance, and so was involved in professional negotiations with the unions, all 22 of them at TU. And I think that we are now at the stage where those of you who have professional negotiation, either skills or experience, or have played such a person on TV, could help us try to figure out the most effective way to get to a single draft. And I'll do one more little piece of my soliloquy and then throw the floor open to you. There's a distinction to be made in, and I'm going to stick just with my role as co-chair. I'm not going to include Roberto in this part. I, up till now, have taken my job to be to facilitate the discussion, but not to mediate it. And by that I mean I view my job as making sure that, to the extent I can, there are clear descriptions of what the rules are, and then that the rules get followed in an orderly way. Mostly what we've been working on is the tricky bit of having to move very, very fast in a process that's not typically done that fast. And I have not participated at all in the content of the discussion, have gone so far as to recuse myself from the business constituency conversations about that because I don't think it's appropriate for me to participate in that. When we get to this process of coming to a single draft, there may be the need for someone or several someones to act as a mediator between parties that hold different positions. And I'm not volunteering to do that because I'm not very good at it and because I don't think I can handle that many roles. But one of the things that I would like to throw into the mix of the next part of this conversation is whether or not we need such a person or two, and if so, where we should go to find them. Now I'm going to turn the floor over to Roberto and then to Eric and then anybody else who wants to jump in the queue. Roberto, go ahead.
Well, I think that there are phases, while I completely agree that at this point in time we shouldn't, we as co-chairs, we shouldn't get into the matter on the table, and we shouldn't take positions on one or the other proposals. And in fact, I've tried whenever I had questions or suggestions to phrase them as not to appear as being on one side rather than the other. I think that when we are getting close to a consensus and when we are getting close to the deadline, it is inevitable that you know, we as co-chairs, we go running around and say, okay, Well, you said 15, but you know, under what circumstances you could accept 13 or 17 and this kind of things. So it is it is feasible in the final round when we are trying to get a consensus and make a consensus poll. It is feasible if until that time we are staying out of the fight. So at that point, I think that you know, we can get in and try to mediate and negotiate and try to figure out what the solutions could be. I mean, that is of course it is something that has to be accepted by the working group, and I think that we will see that in the facts when such time will come. One opportunity is going to be when we have the when we meet in Brussels face to face, because then you know, there's a lot of kind of personal talking with people if we want to do also the work of mediation. That at least is my opinion.
Thanks, Roberto. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, you asked earlier, interesting soliloquies, by the way, for each of you, but previously you asked if there was anything that any of the advocates wanted added to the table, and I'd like to call them for the RFPRO relationship.
Give me the letters again. What is
the registry service provider and the registry operator. Basically, between the technical back end and the two or three people who hold a piece of paper called a contract.
Okay. Consider that request granted. And
I hope I'm on mute now.
And the table.
Not yet. Now you are. There we go. Mike Palage, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. I want to follow up on your point on trying to reach resolution, or I think you used the term mediation. I think two data points that would be very helpful in getting towards that end goal of either mediation or resolution are the following. One, it would be helpful to have someone evaluate the proposals. I think we're now up to a total of, 10 proposals, to evaluate those 10 proposals on merits. Are they consistent with competition law? And again, this goes back to Kathy, I think you pointed to some of the data points that were not originally considered by Salop and Wright. What we've now done is we, the community, have come up with different proposals and different aspects. Let's have these put forward by a group of experts to see how they rank or their viability or whether they're consistent or inconsistent with competition law. That's number one. The other point that is sorely missing from our analysis here is a consideration of the public interest. Almost every proposal here is being put forward by a contracting party, or some, you know, even in dot brands, they will be contracting parties. So when you look within the broader ICANN community and someone who perhaps opine on an important public interest, I think this is something where we need to involve the GAC. And again, I point to the discussions that took place between the board and the GAC in Nairobi, where they talked about involving the GAC earlier into the policy development process. So I think somehow reaching out and getting feedback from the GAC in connection with these proposals would be very important, engaging the public interest. And once you have those two data points, the economist or the experts, as well as the GAC on public interest, then that provides a foundation in which true mediation or resolution, I think, could be achieved.
Thanks, Mike. Quick follow-up question from me, and that is, any bright ideas on how we do that in 3 weeks?
I guess my response back is, the snapshot that you're working towards, I think what we want to do is we want to take that first snapshot, which will be available in 3 weeks, and then perhaps put that out. You know, I don't think we're really going to get towards the resolution or consensus building in 3 weeks. I just don't see that happening. And I think what I'm focusing on is let's take this first snapshot and put it out. And as a case in point, Mikey, look at what we're doing in the high security zone, right? We're kind of putting out the control elements, and we're going to be asking experts to perhaps solicit RFIs, people within the industry, to say, is this a viable mechanism? So I view the snapshot not as here is consensus, but here are potential models for providing the solution, which the ICANN bottom-up consensus process has put forward. And now let's get that expert analysis. Let's consult with the GAC, since, again, they are probably best suited to opine on the public interest of this global resource.
I think I'll save pushing back for a little while, but we do have sort of a time element that's working against us here. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah,
Eric and Pelage, I assume you guys are done, and when you're done, can you put your hands down so that I can keep track of the queue? Alan?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Again, I'm going back to consensus and something you said earlier on the short-term goal and the long-term goal. Your short-term goal is to try to get something in place for the final applicant guidebook for this first round, as it were. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's our only goal.
Which means we're looking for things which the various proposers and the rest of the group can live with, but does not necessarily commit them to that position for the final solution and ultimate way we treat vertical integration in the future.
I think that, to clarify just a little bit,
Okay. It's
what people can live with in this round, if you will. The
right.
Assumption being that then there will be a much longer study that extends, you know, maybe a year or something like that, that comes to
that's what I thought you were saying. I just wanted some clarity, because although people have a reluctance to agreeing with something temporarily because temporary becomes permanent, the intent is that the discussion continue after the first round is locked in, to find something that may be more interesting in the long-term future.
Yes,
okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah,
you may be on mute.
Wanted,
there we go.
Can you hear me? Great.
Yep.
I just wanted to respond to Eric's comment about adding a new line to the table. And this is, of course, part of the problem of being the table drafter, but a specific line. One of the purposes of the table, the goal, was really to distill the key elements of the proposals that most people had commented on and try to compare them against each other. And one of the issues that had come up was back-end registry service providers becoming registrars. I don't believe any proposal has looked at front-ends and back-ends, so I wouldn't support adding that to the table because I don't think that helps our crystallization process.
Thanks, Kathy. Scott?
Thanks, Mikey. I guess, first of all, I like what Mike Pelage had to say in terms of direction, but I guess the question is, as you suggested, how long would it take to get an expert in place? I will say from patent litigation, it seems to me that getting an expert in place is one thing that will help drive consensus, though, because people have to agree on what's the background of the expert and essentially what he's supposed to be doing. And I think that would be helpful, even though it may not be able to be completed within a particular, you know, the time frame for the DAG. The other question I guess I have is the materials that are on the grid right now, do those represent sort of final positions, or are they is this sort of a chessboard that's moving based on what other people add? If somebody changes their position, will this grid change? You know, is this a dream sheet, or were these put in place with the idea that there were going to be alterations based on what others had to say?
Thanks, Scott. my understanding of the current draft of the table is that this will, this is essentially the state of play as of this morning, and that it's possible and in fact likely and in fact encouraged that these positions will change, hopefully converging over the next few weeks. If they don't, we'll find it awfully hard to draw a single document out of them, and we'll basically return to Brussels and say, in the short term, in time for the applicant guidebook, we weren't able to arrive at consensus around any modifications to the board resolution, and we'll move on to our longer, much more exhaustive phase of work. So, yeah, this I think is a fluid document. This is just this morning's version of it. Eric?
Thank you, Michael. In response to Kathy, if the person holding the pen for the matrix is unwilling to add a comment, a column from a competing proposal, then the person should retire from holding the pen. Thank you.
Okay. Jeff Newman, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to comment on a couple things. Mike had Palacios said that we should go out to an expert and see whether this is consistent with competition law. I think that's kind of the wrong question to answer or to ask. It's not whether it's consistent with competition law, because I think all of this is consistent. This is a very unique environment that we have. It's not, well, a lot of people like to think of it as purely private parties dealing with each other in contracts. It's not really that, and it's not fully, it's not a government, but it is quasi-regulatory, no matter what people think about it. So I'm not sure what good it's going to be to bring in an expert, because all they're going to tell you is, well, a normal private, you know, they're going to tell us what Salop and Wright did. When you have private parties dealing with each other in a new industry, this is what's best for consumers. But in a quasi-regulatory environment, that's where things get a little sticky and a little bit different. So I'm not sure what added value that is, although obviously it should go out for comment to everyone, ALAC, GAC, everyone in the community that hasn't participated. I mean, this obviously should go. You know, whether the ALAC speaks for the public interest or the GAC, as I put in my comment on the chat, you know, that's debatable, but obviously it should go out for comment. I thought I understood Eric's point about having a column for registry service provider and registry operator. It wasn't my understanding. Well, then, Eric, then you said something this last time which kind of confused me. I mean, I do think we need to get into the details as to how registry operators and registry service providers should be treated and to avoid some of the gamesmanship that come out of the general principles. But so I didn't understand that as a new proposal. But anyway, and then on the last thing, yes, the grid will change, but, you know, at least in JN Squared, in our proposal, we put down that if the fundamental premise, the ownership or control, if that's not either at or below what we had assumed, then the other assumptions like equal access with registrars and some others may change. And I have a feeling other proposals are probably the same.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm assuming now that the queue is empty. And so here's my thought, which is what we did in Minnesota. You know, we had folks that were fairly far apart. I was on one extreme, the carriers were on another. And what we did is we broke into small groups and wrote essentially pieces of the report in small groups and brought them back, you know, brought back these pieces of proposed language that had been hammered on by hopefully people with very divergent points of view before they came back to the main body. Those chunks of language then got hammered out again by the main body, and if we could get to agreement, so be it. And if we couldn't, we sent it back for another work cycle of rewrite. And that's an approach that's by no means necessarily the right one, but that's the one I would throw out on the table as the way that we tackle this for the next two or three meetings, to see if we can indeed get to a single draft that can be supported by hopefully everybody. If not everybody, then I think it has to be a pretty substantial consensus. Otherwise, we're going to have a very hard time selling it back into the community. But again, this is where my question is to those of you who've done some of these big, complicated negotiations within the ICANN context before. Have any experiences that you felt worked really well to getting to a single draft like that? We basically have not very much time, and that's the way that I thought of to do it, but I'm all ears for other approaches. I'm gonna take that silence, I hope, as agreement and not dismay. And turn then the conversation to what kinds of chunks does the matrix, the table, or just your knowledge of where we're at present as to what kinds of pieces of a single draft we could start writing, and then maybe try and recruit a few people to write some of those chunks. Tim, Eric, Tim first, then Eric, then others. Go ahead.
Mine is back.
Hello?
Before your recent question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hear you.
Yeah, okay. My mind is back. My comments about the what would we just agree to by not saying anything? Could you recap that? Because a lot's been going on, both on the call as well as on the chat, and so I kind of lost track.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, basically what I'm proposing is that, well, I'm proposing two things. One thing that I'm proposing is that we begin with this call to transition to crafting a single document rather than a series of proposals, and that single document is, if we can craft one, the document that we take forward to Brussels. So that's part A. And then part B is break the drafting into chunks and encourage people with divergent points of view to join together in writing those chunks as a preliminary draft, that then those chunks get brought back to this group next week for debate, refinement, acceptance or non-acceptance. So really two parts. Switch to writing a single draft and break it into chunks and get to work.
Okay, so just follow-up question then. You know, I guess I'm not as optimistic as maybe others that will have, you know, a single convergence. I think Jeff Newman makes a good point, you know, that it's going to be somewhat of a moving target because as, you know, a large number might come to agreement on a particular issue, then that might change, you know, views on other aspects that we're looking at in this grid, for example. So I'm confused about how we're going to, you know, are we, by doing the single document, then are we throwing out, how are we going to make sure that when we're done, we've captured, you know, here may be the things that there is some consensus on, it'll never be unanimous. I think that's just impractical to even assume. But here's the things that we have, you know, rough consensus on, whatever you want to call it. But it still would be including, you know, other views. I hope we're not implying that we're only going to give a single document that says, you know, A, B, C, D, and E, and this is it, and then we're not going to include, you know, minority views or other views. Now, if we can just talk a little bit more about what this document is going to look like, that would be helpful, I guess.
Thanks, Tim. I think that's a good question. In my mind, we either come to a document that we all can line up behind, or we don't. And if we don't, if we have minority, if this is a debate that we had in the broadband context. We set as the goal and met that goal of not having a minority report. And the reason that we did that is because we wanted to present a united front to the legislature and the governor of our state that this is the direction that we advise them to go. I think if we include or if we feel we have to include minority reports in our document, then we have not, you know, we've essentially then thrown the decision back to the bodies that asked us to make the decision, namely the board. And so I think what the board is saying is we've got a track that we've laid down. If you can come to consensus on some other track, we will open the door and provide a mechanism to get that inserted into the DAG, maybe. Because it's above my pay grade to predict what the board would actually do. But I think that if we come in with minority reports, then effectively we won't have moved the ball forward.
Well, Mikey, that's just not the way we typically do things within ICANN policy. I mean, you know, and the reality is that very rarely, you know, is there that kind of complete consensus. I'm trying to think of an example where we had, you know, unanimous consensus on a major policy issue. And I'm just trying to be realistic here because it has a big impact on how we proceed. If we're going to proceed with the idea that, you know, we're all going to come to 100% consensus on something, then, you know, we have a blank sheet of paper, and that's probably what we ought to present because that's about what we're going to end up with unanimous consensus on. I'm just trying to be realistic here and not start this process with you know, some concept or idea that just isn't workable. I mean,
well,
I don't know how others view it, but I cannot imagine that we're going to have a 100% consensus view on even one thing, let alone, you know, a number of things.
You know, I think that what this gets down to is essentially a question of the art of the possible. It's clear that given the amount of time we've got and the underpinnings that we've got, that we cannot make recommendations that dramatically change either the status quo as of today or the status quo of the board resolution because we don't have the time or the underpinnings to do that. On the other hand, I think we do have the opportunity and we've been invited by the board to do this to make some modest suggestions that can get folded into the DAG if we can agree to them. And that's why I think that the negotiation part of this is going to be so important. Because just like in the other negotiations that I've participated in, this is the horse trading period. This is going to be the period where people are going to give up something in order to get something else that they feel is more valuable. And we may not be able to do that, in which case that's fine. I don't necessarily think that there's a pejorative or, you know, a negative connotation for that. But I think that that's what we've been asked to do, is to come up with those things which we can agree on in a really short period of time. And in terms of the usual I can't process. I agree. I mean, simply the time frame is not the usual process. But that's the cards that we were dealt. And so, you know, we'll play them and see how they fall. I think that's the best answer.
I know that's the cards that were dealt, Mikey, and which is unfortunate because I think some of these things have value, but there's just no way that we can really resolve all the issues associated within the time frame that we have, you know, to make everybody comfortable. So I think that's my point, that we haven't rarely ever come to 100% unanimous consensus on any major policy issue, even when we've had years to deal with it. You're talking about weeks, and we want to start this with the expectation that we'll somehow come to some sort of unanimous agreement on these issues. No.
Well, I don't think I agree with you, Tim, that the odds of us coming to 100% unanimous agreement on all the issues that are in this table is a Herculean.
Well, I'll be happy. I'd be absolutely thrilled, eat crow or my shoe or something else we want to present, if we come to 100% agreement on one issue. Seriously, I'd be thrilled about it. I just think we ought to have realistic expectations going into this.
Right. Well, I think that it's, you know, I think it's important to set the expectations correctly. And it's true that some of these issues just aren't going to get resolved. And I think that's part of the reason why the board did what they did. You know, they can't wait for us. They need to get moving. And so they've resolved them for us unless we change it. And then dealt us a really interesting hand. Eric? You're next.
Thank you, Mikey. I have a process suggestion, which is to divide the proposal writing up into the proposals which deal with the standard type, the proposals which deal with the community type, and the proposals which deal with some other type. I think that some of the areas of non-agreement arise from the differences in types that each proponent has addressed. But I share with him the observation that a single report is very unlikely. And a plus one to just about everything that Tim said, unfortunately. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate the suggestion. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Thanks. I think that, Mike, I got to respectfully disagree about having to have completely unanimous, and I think I was a member of the STI, you know, the trademark group, and we had, I think that can be an excellent template because there were certain positions where people had minority, you know, there were minority opinions there, and those were stated, and people, but the group was able to come to some rough consensus about some pieces and some other parts to it, and it was accepted by the board, and I think that the process worked well. So I don't think we're going to be able to get to an all or nothing, but I do agree with you that there is going to be some horse trading and deal making going on now, and it is going on at the moment. But I think that if somebody has a strong minority opinion on something, if we do come to this, then we should let them express it because it could be something that others will want to know about. And just because we're not going to reach consensus, I mean, 100% doesn't mean we shouldn't let other voices still be heard in our final report.
Thanks, Jeff. And, you know, I also want to make it clear that this point of view on the minority report stuff isn't my decision to make. It's really the working group's decision to make. It's just the way that we did it in Minnesota. And,
okay. Well, yeah, I was going to say in this group we've seen some very good success with the STI, and I think the group could look at the report I think it would work as a template from how we could go forward with this process and what, I don't know, maybe the final result could look like.
For those of you that were on the STI. What was sort of the sequence of events? Who carried the pen? Who, you know, was it done mostly on phone calls? Was it done mostly on the list? Was it done with a small group? I mean, that's one of the things that I was very curious about, was examples of processes that worked really well, really fast.
Oh, it's Jeff here again. I think that for me it was, we had twice weekly calls, and we one call was on the rights protection, the other one was on the, you know, it was split up so that each call was focusing on a separate issue, and it was all done on the list and on calls. There were, I don't believe, maybe I wasn't invited, but I don't remember face-to-face on that, or maybe I completely blocked it out of my mind, but it was mostly done on the list.
So, was there a draft that was getting passed back and forth on the list and getting marked up?
Yes, there was, and I think Kathy had a hand in that when she was in her old position. She was working on that, and a few others did. It wasn't one person who had the pen, but there were drafts about what people were working on, and each constituency was putting forth their comments and their thoughts into the draft. And I'll let some others on the SPI, who are on the call, if they want to speak up of what you thought were the positives and what made it work well.
Brian, I see you in the queue. By the way, I'm going to take a time check and note that we are at the end of our official time. And I apologize for running over, but if you can hang in with me for another 10 minutes while we drive this to ground, it would be helpful. Brian, oh, you disappeared. Alan? Are you talking about the STI thing?
I was going to talk about the STI. I mean, there are a significant number of differences. One of them was that was a, I'm not sure balance is the right group, but it was a representative group. And you know, it dawned on me as we're looking at these proposals that if the JN squared proposers had not collapsed theirs into one, they would have more lines, and it would look like, you know, 15% or some other position had a stronger position than they do right now. So there's no real merit, there's no benefit in negotiating right now. You almost lose position with every negotiation, and I think the issue on the STI was people had absolute ultimate goals which they wanted to achieve, and sometimes got and sometimes didn't. But they weren't going into it saying it's my proposal or the other guy's proposal. It was handled on a much more a piecemeal basis. And we knew exactly what our target is, whereas here we're talking about two different targets, a short and long term, and some of the proposals have said clearly this is a short-term proposal, we'll talk later, and other ones, I think from the context, look like it's a long-term. So we're going into it with almost two different complete mindsets, which didn't happen in the SGI.
Okay. Jeff Newman, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was heavily involved in the SGI and in a lot of the drafting, as was Kathy. And, you know, there are a couple differences between the groups, but a couple similarities. The differences are that there was nothing in the background. In other words, there were no secrets. Everyone was open and honest as to what they were trying to achieve and why, whereas here you have business plans and you have companies that are not willing to, for legitimate reasons, are not willing to share exactly why they want a particular proposal and what their business plans are. In the STI, you know, we rolled up our sleeves and we basically said, and from a registry perspective, it was, you know, Jeff, tell me how a registry could implement this, and when you say it's not feasible, why? And we really went into the details because there was no hidden agenda. There was no, you know, Neustar's business plans relied on any of this stuff, or any of the registries really business plans relied on any of this stuff. But this is so different in the sense of you have real businesses here that are not sharing their business plans for legitimate reasons, that are counting on this, and they're not going to disclose it. So, you know, it's really tough to kind of compare the two groups in that sort of way. But on the other hand, what we could do still is, which we did in that group, is we had targeted conference calls. We basically said, in a much smaller number of people, where we said, look, on this conference call next week, we are going to discuss specifically the clearinghouse and how a registry can interface with the clearinghouse and what the difficulties are, right? And we had an hour, two-hour targeted discussion on that. Here, I suppose we could break it down into smaller issues and just have smaller calls, but I don't know. I mean, I look for suggestions on that. I wouldn't rule it out completely.
Thanks, Jeff. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Mikey. I just want to let the FBI comments clear out. And I apologize. I had to jump off for a bit, and I may have missed some of the answers to these questions. But I'm a little bit confused because it seems as though there have been some mixed signals recently. One sense that there might be kind of a two-step process here where the group comes together around items that might show strong support or maybe even, God forbid, consensus, put those up to the council in this time period before Brussels and keep working on some others to see if there's a second phase where consensus or strong support develops and then put those up to the council sometime down the road this year. I'm hearing now it's we got to get it done, we got to get in for Brussels. Can I ask what's motivating that we've got to get it all done for Brussels? And I want to make one comment. I think all of us recognize that there was, by design, an artificial aspect of the board resolution, which was the sharp point of something to get us all around this table to negotiate. And we recognize that. We're all here. Everything Jeff just said is true, but I've sensed nothing but, you know, genuine attempts to try to get to a final position by the group. Is there also an artificial element to this, we got to get it done by Brussels now, message that we're hearing? Because, frankly, my own sense, and maybe I'm naive, is that we're all a bunch of adults. We've been working very hard. Yes, we're all self-interested. But I don't think if there's artificiality in putting a time pressure to our head to make something happen, I don't sense there's anyone around this table who's not going to work hard regardless to try to get something up to the council in the short term. We all recognize what's at stake. So my question is this real or is there something artificial about this deadline?
This is Mikey. Since I'm the person in charge of routes and deadlines, let me comment. I'm working under sort of two assumptions. One is that in order to get, well, one assumption is that the draft of the applicant guidebook that's going up this time is going to be the last one. I have to make that assumption. Presuming that that's the case, we've already missed the deadline, the formal deadline, for getting input into that process. But essentially, we've been offered a window by the board, and I've confirmed it with Kurt, that we have some more time. I was negotiating like crazy about a month ago, and there was just no way that we would make the May 15th deadline. And so we have an extension, effectively. But that extension is still constrained by the fact that, you know, we still got to get this stuff to them effectively pretty quick because we have to get it through the GNSO Council, and then we have to get it through the board and then into the guidebook. And so there's no artificiality in terms of that deadline unless you assume that there's going to be another iteration of the applicant guidebook, which I can't. If as soon as there's an indication of that, then the constraint disappears. The long-term discussion may be where confusion has come in. Way early in this conversation, I published a little memo to the list about a two-phase approach. And the long-term that I've been referring to is very long, a year plus, and involves experts and economists and all the stuff that folks have mentioned, and effectively is not aimed at the current round of GTLD applicants. So it may be that there's been confusion in terms of short and long term that I've introduced by accident. I didn't mean to do that. Is that clear it up for you, Brian? on mute. Or maybe I did clear it up. Anyway, we're running out of time, people. I need to get a quick sense of where we go from here. Is it reasonable to carry this on to the list? Do we need to drive this to ground on this call? Do we have the time to wait a week? What should we do? My immediate thought is...
Hey, Mike, this is Tim. I have a comment on that. If you're...
Yeah, go ahead. Please do.
One thing I wonder is... that, well, I don't have to wonder. I know that behind the scenes, so to speak, a number of us have been working on negotiating, trying to, find some ground for compromise, whatever. And it seems to me that maybe, we should give, one more opportunity for, these different parties or groups, whoever have been working together, to, somehow, make some sort of consolidated response or proposal or kind of update the group on where everyone's at so that we can maybe start this other process, a little bit further down the road than kind of going back and redoing a lot of the work that's already been done by several people behind the scenes. At least that's what I suspect. And I've been involved in that myself. So, just a suggestion that maybe we give one more shot over a short period of time here to update where we're at, and then move on from there.
So one approach would be to let that process unfold over the following week and see where we've arrived at next week's call. Does that sound like a reasonable time interval for that to happen?
Mikey, if we're even thinking about a second meeting for the week, we should start a doodle on the potential time for it now.
Yeah.
Next week is going to be too late to schedule one 2 days later.
Yeah, we'll get that underway as well. Roberto, go ahead.
I wanted just to reinforce first the fact that we need some results for Brussels, because there are three possibilities. Either we get it done by Brussels, or we arrive in Brussels knowing that. There's no possibility of compromising on any, and we are absolutely at zero, and those are the two clean-cut situations. But if we get some work done, if we get some points of consensus, if we get some draft of possibility into Brussels, that will give the possibility of negotiating some more time. I think that if we are on the way to get a result, I think that we can go to the community and say, okay, we had a commitment to have results at that point in time. We are on the way, and we just need a little bit of more time. And that's a completely different thing than to start from the beginning in saying, okay, we are not going to get it done for Brussels. So this said, considering that that's my approach, the obvious consequence is that we need now to dig into the matrix. I don't know if we need another call this week or if we can let it go for a week and have everything on next Monday. Maybe we need to launch a doodle poll. Because if we are going to have another call this week where half of the people will not be able to participate, that will start having a bit of bad feelings. I'm not under the impression that now a couple of days more or a couple of days less is the important thing before we get a new call. The important thing is what we are going to achieve in the next call. So I think that we need some kind of groundwork that we can do on the list. For instance, to see what are the important things in the matrix, what are there any rows that we can combine, can we add some qualify some of the values in the sense that can we just check because when and I did send a message on the chat. There are some people who say zero, some people 15%, and some people 100%. Now, some of the people might say it's either 15% or we are not going to have any deal. But some other people might say, well, it's 15%, but I can live with 20. So I think that we need to explore what are the soft possibilities now that we have the hard possibilities on the table, hard-coded in the matrix. And I think that maybe it will be useful now that we have the full matrix on the table to leave also the possibility to different proponents to get in touch by phone and say, okay, well, can we, you know, can we come to a more joint agreement on that, or so that we can diminish, we can simplify the matrix. Maybe I'm reasoning like a mathematician, which is what I am, but I'm trying to reduce the complexity of the matrix in order to make it more manageable, and then go to the next stage. That's all.
Thanks, Roberto. Brian, are you in the queue still, or was that left over from before? The silence either indicates mute or left over from before. I'm going to keep talking, and Brian, if you were really in the queue, you can break in. I think that that we're all sort of arriving at the same place, which is, you know, now is the time to sort of do what we can to simplify the matrix, continue the negotiations that have been going on, identify the soft spots. I don't think it's practical to put another call into people's schedule this week. I think it would be very difficult to find that, but we will do a doodle poll for a second call next week, which will give people a little bit more time to react. And I will reflect on the call that we've just had and reflect with Roberto, and we'll write a little description of what we're going to try and get accomplished on the next call. And would be more than open to any suggestions from anybody that's participated in these things before. I'm actually quite hopeful that we will have moved the ball forward quite a bit for Brussels. And I thank you all for working so hard so far and continuing that good work. And with that, I am terribly sorry that we ran over. I will try very hard not to do that again, and we'll draw this one to a close. See you next week. And thanks.